Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you, with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Earlier today, our medical experts announced a plan for booster shots to every fully vaccinated American, adult American.
On Wednesday afternoon, President Biden announced what his administration had been telegraphing for several days.
The plan is for every adult to get a booster shot 8 months after you got your second shot.
In addition to vaccine mandates for some nursing home employees and an aggressive pushback on mask bans in schools, the administration wants adults who got the Pfizer or Moderna vaccine to be eligible for a third shot, starting as early as September 20th.
It will make you safer and for longer, and it will help us end the pandemic faster.
And hearing that made me wonder, will it?
I don't know, honestly.
That's Saad Omer, the director of the Yale Institute for Global Health.
So there are two things, two variables there. There is, what do we mean by end the pandemic? So the longstanding pandemic and infectious disease experts at this point don't have high expectations of elimination or eradication.
Instead, they expect the virus to be something we control aggressively, but live with. And then there's the other variable. How much is protection from the vaccines waning?
It's pretty clear data that there is some waning happening. And either it's waning or it's a effect of Delta. And I think it's a bit of both.
For some people, Saad says, boosters make sense. The immunocompromised, maybe the elderly.
But I was sort of a bit surprised about the recent discussion of a blanket third booster.
So why is the administration promoting them? Today on the show, do we all need third shots? I'm Lizzie O'Leary, and you're listening to What Next TBD, a show about technology, power, and how the future will be determined. Stick with us.
Apple Card is the perfect cashback rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank, USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
The first thing I asked Saad Omer to do is walk me through the data. It's important to note that we're talking about the Pfizer and Moderna vaccines in this episode. The Biden administration says they'll be talking about the Johnson & Johnson vaccine in the coming weeks. On Wednesday, the president's top COVID advisors cited a few early studies to make the case for boosters. From New York, from nursing homes, from the Mayo Clinic. Plus, there was some data from Israel.
I see two things. First, I see a few canaries in the coal mine. I do see that there is, especially from based on U.S. data, there is a diminishing of effectiveness against mild to moderate disease.
Here's Rochelle Walensky, the director of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, on Wednesday, talking about a Mayo Clinic analysis of more than 80,000 vaccinated and unvaccinated people.
Like we saw in the New York data, vaccine effectiveness against infection declined over time. In this case, from 76% to 42% for those who received the Pfizer vaccine, and from 86% to 76% for those who received the Moderna vaccine.
I also see that things seem to be holding up against severe disease, including hospitalization, more or less.
Which seems great.
It seems great, which is good. The other thing I see is whenever things are that nuanced, I want to see the whole ACIP process unfold.
he means the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices. It's a group of 15 outside advisors, doctors, nurses, public health specialists, who make recommendations to the CDC on vaccines. On COVID, yes, but on other things, too. And the committee has a standard deliberative process that anyone, you or me, can log on and watch.
The encouraging thing, and something that got lost in a lot of coverage, was that the actual wording of things that came out yesterday was that they are doing this for planning purposes to start with September 20th, pending authorization from FDA and pending the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices review. So I, as a scientist, I'd wait for the ACIP review because things are that nuanced.
The administration recommended that this start next month. But when I look at places with big surges in both cases and hospitalizations, Texas, for example, over 90% of the cases in Texas are in the unvaccinated. Why do booster shots if that is not the group of people who are, you know, the most threatened right now?
So this is the reason why, you know, we want to see a more nuanced discussions. And that's part of it, like sort of if the it's the unvaccinated that are contributing the highest burden. It is unclear how much gain in actual effectiveness there will be with the third dose. Remember, increase in antibody responses after the third dose is very much expected, even if it doesn't have an additional benefit, because there are these recall responses that if you vaccinate someone again, so there's a sort of, you know, a burst of antibody because they remember.
Their immune system kicks back into overdrive.
Exactly. And so what implications it actually has on effectiveness, that, again, doesn't 100% solve that question. So yes, that's part of it. But also, look, those of us who talk about global vaccine equity, what is the best use of the next available dose? It's not just that we are all warm and fuzzy people who want to save the world at the expense of anything here in the U.S. Part of the fact is that the history will judge us poorly if we are too selfish. But part of it is hard-nosed calculus on our part is what is the best public health strategy to get this beast under control. And there is evidence. There was a really nice paper in Science. We did our work back in November. That looked at saying that, you know, having after a certain level of vaccination coverage, it may be best to donate a huge chunk of doses outside the U.S. to get this outbreak under control. We can't build Fortress America when it comes to infectious diseases. We know that for decades, and the fact that new variants emerge in places where this is rampant. We need to keep in mind what is the best use of the next available dose.
So let's get into that criticism a little bit. If you look at, say, the numbers in Indonesia, where, you know, children are dying, the, you know, rate of spread seems quite high. The WHO has said wealthy countries should stop boosters and send doses to poorer ones. How is this moral?
Well, that's a question we need to ask. And I do think that countries do have a bigger responsibility. It's not just the U.S. towards their own population, but that responsibility is not absolute. And where you draw the line is that if there is a reasonably clear benefit to a high-risk population, let's say, you know, nobody had any issues with the immunocompromised individuals because you knew that, you know, within the U.S., there was a clear benefit. So that's what I'm saying, that there is a higher burden. It's not an impossible burden, but a higher burden. You don't do a third dose from a just-in-case perspective.
No, there's some world leaders who say America shouldn't get a third shot until other countries got their first shot. I disagree. We can take care of America and help the world at the same time. In June and July, America administered 50 million shots here in the United States, and we donated 100 million shots to other countries.
Biden pledged that the U.S. would donate another 200 million vaccine doses to other countries over the fall and winter. But that number is roughly a third of the vaccine stockpile that the U.S. is currently sitting on.
A couple of things. I do think that we should have worked, you know, as I've been sort of appropriating Martin Luther King's word, with the fierce urgency of now.
Yeah.
I think we should have switched very quickly to the Operation Warp Speed, a global version of it. And with the same urgency, yes, you know, when you talk to folks who have been involved with these things, they say, of course, there is an effort. No, but not with the same urgency if your own grandma's life was on the line. The other thing is a lot of them are scheduled to be delivered through next year, and people need those vaccines right now.
When we come back, how should most of us respond to this week's announcement?
Hey everybody, it's Neil. I've got some huge news. Decoder is moving to Mondays and Thursdays. We're adding a second episode of the show. On Mondays, we'll have our classic interviews with CEOs and other troublemakers.
I think we're going to have to start having conversations about how do we pay those jobs that can't be done by AI.
And on Thursdays, we'll be explaining big topics in the news with Verge reporters, experts, and other friends of the show.
There's a new generation of people on the internet. Google search has always sucked for them. So, you know, there's no reason for them to be loyal. They can just go to TikTok.
This is going to be really fun. I'm very excited about all this. So go subscribe wherever you get your podcasts now.
Hi, this is Dahlia Lithwick, host of Slate's legal podcast, Amicus. If you're listening to this show, you might be interested in Amicus's live show that we're hosting in Washington, D.C. on Tuesday, May the 14th. My colleague, Mark Joseph Stern, and I will be talking to some amazing guests, including Sherrilyn Ifill and a sitting state Supreme Court justice, all about how originalism, a relatively recently invented way of interpreting the Constitution, has taken over the Supreme Court and radically reshaped the law. It's been doctrinal rocket fuel for the conservative legal movement and facilitated the rolling back of abortion rights, the expansion of gun rights, and the obliteration of the separation of church and state. And as another wildly consequential Supreme Court term careers to its end, the court's originalists are on a tear. But there's something you can do about it, and we hope you'll join us in D.C. on May 14th to explore the possible pathways out of the current situation. Go to slate.com/amicuslive for tickets.
You're listening to What Next TBD. I'm Lizzie O'Leary, and I'm talking with Saad Omer, the director of the Yale Institute for Global Health. I want to be very careful not to give fuel to anti-vaxxers, but I wonder if you worry at all that some people will look at this recommendation and say, oh, well, if the shots don't work as well as they thought, why do it at all?
Yeah, no, but that's a real possibility. That's something that we should be thinking about in terms of messaging. We should follow the science. If the evidence suggests, you know, there's a clear benefit, especially in terms of severe disease, you know, by all means, do that. And then worry about communications. But now we are in the gray zone, and I think we need to be super careful about this.
Well, so why do this now? The, you know, committee has not met, as you've said. There was currently no authorization for this. Last week, we did a show on the FDA, and this feels awfully close to politicians getting ahead of the FDA.
Well, so I can't read their minds. But I can tell you the regular order of things is that a request comes from the political appointees, and it's reasonable for the ACIP to consider that.
What the administration seems to be saying is we've learned that if we wait with this virus, it is too late, that they're coming from sort of a better safe than sorry point of view. Do you think that's valid?
Well, I think we should explicitly look at the trade-offs. And the trade-off is that what are the implications on our long-term security in terms of, you know, what is the best use of the next dose? And you know, full disclosure, I serve on the WHO's COVID-19 vaccine working group. And having been part of that process, I can tell you it does tend to clarify a lot of these questions.
I want to ask you about some interesting criticism I saw from Dr. Katie Stevenson at Harvard. And she essentially said we cannot boost our way out of a COVID surge, either in the U.S. or abroad that we need to, you know, get vaccines to the unvaccinated. But she went on to say that the U.S. needs better ventilation, more masking, you know, paid time off. I wonder if you think, as an epidemiologist, that focusing on vaccination might limit the portfolio of public health measures that we have as a country and as a society to fight the epidemic, or whether vaccines really are the best hope.
Well, as someone who has spent the last 20 years of his life primarily working on vaccine research, I do other research as well, I can tell you that she's right. That we need a whole, I may phrase it differently, but we may need the full toolbox of tools to counter this pandemic in the short run. In the long run, you may be able to sort of say that, you know, once you have achieved sustainable control of the outbreak where it's not a life-altering pathogen for the society, then you can sort of mostly rely on vaccines. But it's entirely correct that if you're opening up schools, you need more toolbox in your toolset. But even if you're opening up universities, where, you know, at Yale, our latest data suggests that we are 95% immunization coverage in students. And this is an underestimate because some students are still uploading their documentation and some of our international students are catching up. But even in those situations, it's part of a multi-pronged strategy. So masking and other efforts are still being undertaken, even in high vaccination coverage situations.
You know, you have been, I've listened to you steer me toward nuance, steer me back to the science, and it's making me think. You have this cartoon that is pinned to the top of your Twitter profile. And it's a bunch of people lined up by a sign that says answers. And there's like a big group of people veering towards simple but wrong, and only a tiny group going toward complex but right. And I just feel like we have spent a year and a half trying to have simple solutions. Why don't you think political leaders are willing to say things that are complex?
Well, look, they have incentives for simplicity. When you're a political leader, you know, you have incentives for simplicity. You have incentives for action, even if you're, you know, wanting to do the right thing. But it is the job of people like us. It's the job of people who do this stuff for a living to make sure that these conversations are nuanced. I'm full aware that a couple of my earlier answers were way longer than you know, what's ideal for a podcast. But it was needed.
So how should we, as a public, sit with this week's announcement? Because yes, the science is nuanced, but as people who are tired or worried about their kids or worried about their parents, how should we receive it?
That's a really good question. It's a tough question to answer because there is understandable confusion. I would say some of it is with the understanding that it's an evolving outbreak. The second thing is to understand the sincerity, but also fallibility of public health leaders. That these are not perfect people, but they are sincere people. Cut them some slack. Even if you disagree with them, and I do that all the time, that even if I disagree with a specific policy point, and that's true. The other thing I would say, one way of cutting through the noise is look for folks who have been doing this stuff, you know, respiratory disease, virology, immunology, and epidemiology before the pandemic hit. I can tell you I have drawn so many times from previous experiences that have stopped me from making sort of rash errors in judgment. I haven't been perfect, and there is disagreement between experienced people. So the reason why everyone respects Tony Fauci, Dr. Fauci, it seems now his first name is Doctor, is not because he's always right. And he would be the first person to admit that. But he comes from a place of experience. The second thing is look for the cumulative wisdom of experts, like the ACIP. And so these are some imperfect but useful ways of sifting through the noise.
Saad says that for now, if you're vaccinated, don't panic. There's no need to try to finagle a third shot. Let the advisory panels do their thing, and the next few weeks should bring more data and with it, more clarity. So if you watch this announcement this week, wait.
I would say, you know, even the announcement said, wait, they plan to roll it out on September 20th. I would say, wait, don't freelance it this time. Unless you are immunocompromised, then by all means, go and get it. Even if you're on the fence about it, if you think maybe you're immunocompromised, maybe you're not, go out and talk to your physician. But for a general recommendations, even the yesterday's announcement said that they plan to roll out around September 20th.
Saad Omer, thank you very much for your time.
My pleasure.
Saad Omer is the director of the Yale Institute for Global Health. And that is our show for today. This episode was produced by Alyssa Eads. We're edited by Tori Bosch and Allison Benedict. Alicia Montgomery is the executive producer for Slate Podcasts. And TBD is part of the larger What Next family. It's also part of Future Tense, a partnership of Slate, Arizona State University, and New America. And I want to take a moment and recommend that you go back and listen to Thursday's episode of What Next. You'll hear the stories of Afghans who worked with the United States and are now stuck trying to get out. Mary Harris will be back next week. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. Thanks for listening.
Hi, I'm Jeremy Stahl. I'm Slate's jurisprudence editor. Ordinarily, I edit our courts and legal coverage from the comfort of my home office in Los Angeles, but for the next month and a half, I will be locked in a lower Manhattan courtroom with the rest of the press, a jury of 12 New Yorkers, Justice Juan Merchan, prosecutors, Trump's defense team, and the former president himself as history unfolds. I've temporarily moved myself and my family from Los Angeles to New York to cover this case firsthand, like I have done in other cases, including the Paul Manafort case, the Roger Stone criminal trial, and Donald Trump's first impeachment. I'm hoping that my background knowledge of the many, many criminal travails of our former president can offer something to you, Slate's listener. Over the next several weeks, you'll be hearing from me on Amicus, Slate's legal podcast, and in articles on Slate.com. From the jury selection to the opening arguments to the witness testimony and cross-examination and the prosecution's case and the defense's case and ultimately to a final verdict. We will be providing you wall-to-wall coverage throughout the entirety of the trial as it unfolds from the courtroom. There's no way I'd be able to do it without the support of Slate Plus. So if you're not already a subscriber, please join today by clicking Try Free at the top of the Amicus show page on Apple Podcasts or visit slate.com/amicusplus to get access wherever you listen. Thank you so, so much.
I'm Dahlia Lithwick, and I'm host of Amicus, Slate's podcast about the law and the U.S. Supreme Court. We are shifting into high gear, coming at you weekly with the context you need to understand the rapidly changing legal landscape. The many trials of Donald J. Trump, judicial ethics, arguments and opinions at SCOTUS. We are tackling the big legal news with clarity and insight every single week. New Amicus episodes every Saturday, wherever you listen.